This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It doesn't necessarily show that there was collusion in the scheme, but it shows that Don Jr. was collusion curious.
Look, I think Donald Jr.'s statements stand for themselves.
This is evidence of willingness to commit collusion.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast. I'm Virginia Heffernan. TrumpCast is the show that has room in its big, warm embrace for anyone named Donald Trump, including Don Jr., the son of the President of the United States. We are way, way too decorous on TrumpCast to call him like Uday. We'll call him Jr. Jr. is the one who, a year ago, agreed to meet with the Russian government lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya and was super psyched to have some stuff to add to the campaign slam book on Hillary Clinton. The New York Times scored the emails that set up the meeting, and when Jr. was told the Times was going to publish them, he tweeted the stuff himself, the emails himself. The emails are between Jr. and the very credible and dignified-looking Rob Goldstone, a British-born former tabloid reporter and entertainment publicist. So basically, you know, one of those admirals, saints, and doctors without borders, a man of great propriety and lawfulness. So here's how the emails went. Rob Goldstone wrote to Jr. on June 3rd, 2016 at 10:36 a.m. Good morning. The Crown Prosecutor of Russia, sidebar, there's no such thing, has offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. This is obviously very high-level and sensitive information, sidebar not sensitive enough that it doesn't belong on emails sent on iPhones, but is part of Russia and its government support for Donald Trump. How should we handle this information? Do you want to meet and talk about it in person? Not 20 minutes later, Jr. fires back, "Thanks, Rob. I appreciate that. If it's what you say, I love it, especially later in the summer. Could we do a call first thing next week when I'm back?" Well, the emails turned into a meeting attended by Jared Kushner and also Paul Manafort, whom Jr. refers to as campaign boss, and the rest is fast evolving history. Here to make some sense of this madness is Robert Bauer. He's an American attorney who previously served as White House counsel under President Barack Obama. But first, these messages.
Hi. I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus, So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
My guest today is Robert Bauer, who served as White House counsel under President Barack Obama. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you.
So, Bob, you know how they say, people ask on Twitter, can you imagine what would have happened if Obama had done XYZ kind of thing that Trump does? Well, I'm going to ask you to imagine something. What would have happened inside Obama's White House if there had been revelations that, say, Malia Obama had communicated with, say, Iran to try to score dirty information about Mitt Romney?
I suppose there's a first question, which is, you know, what are the chances that anything like that would have happened? I mean, I just want to pause for a second and say, nobody can probably know for a long time to come, and maybe the question will never be answered, what sort of, you know, sort of complete breakdown in process allowed a meeting like the one that we saw reflected in the emails to occur. It just seems to me that it had to have passed, you know, across a number of desks, and apparently, against anything we might imagine, the probabilities would be, nobody said, I don't think this is a good idea. So that's one thing. Then you ask the question of, well, what would happen if the emails then surfaced, or there was a report in the newspaper about the emails? Would I recommend that a client in those circumstances, you know, you provided a particular hypothetical, but I'll take it more generally than that, that they go ahead and, you know, post the emails in full on Twitter? Probably not. I realize that Donald Trump Jr. was trying to beat the New York Times to the punch. I accept that. I'm still not 100% sure for a variety of reasons what the strategy behind the disclosure was. It's not clear to me why the president then was advised that it was sensible for him to tweet out commendation to his son for his transparency. I mean, there's a phrase, the world gone mad. I mean, from a lawyer's point of view, or from the point of view of somebody who's been exposed to reasonably disciplined process, both in the campaign world and in the executive branch, you know, all I can do is remember, you know, this has a Pink Panther feel to it. I mean, sort of Peter Sellers comedy where it's very hard to understand what's going on here. But what's not hard to understand is the intentions of the participants in that meeting, sort of what they understood about the meeting when they went into it, what they hope to get out of it, and how it might connect to other concerns we have about the Trump administration's relationship to Russia in this campaign. So process is one thing, content is something else.
So there's certainly an argument, and people have wanted to pile on to Don Jr. as being, you know, idiotic and arrogant and all these other things, that his emails and activities might be primarily a personal problem, that he was kind of acting out or you know, just trying to be a free agent, and that this may end with him getting detention or taking a long time out, but is not going to have broader implications. But it sounds like you don't take that argument very seriously.
It's very hard to take seriously for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, the suggestion that he was, if you will, going rogue and he was acting entirely on his own is belied by the fact that he invited successfully the campaign manager and a senior advisor of the campaign, the candidate's son-in-law, to the meeting, and they both attended. Also, they were copied on the emails in which the relationship of Russia to this venture was disclosed, the purpose of the meeting was disclosed, the identity of the individual they apparently knew nothing about was disclosed. She was described in those emails as a Russian government lawyer. I don't think this is a Donald Jr. problem. It may be a Donald Jr. problem in the sense that he'll have to answer for it in one respect or another. He'll certainly give testimony. But what this becomes is a Trump organization problem. In other words, these were agents acting on behalf of a principal, which is the Trump campaign. And so what this episode reveals is that you don't have a series of sort of foolish entrepreneurs wandering around the landscape looking for Clinton dirt. You have what many people suspected was the case, a concerted strategic effort on the part of the Trump campaign to locate opposition research wherever they can. That per se, by the way, is not exceptional. Campaigns do that all the time, but willing to do so in collaboration with a foreign government.
And can you think of any time past where maybe through a third party or someone representing him or herself as acting independently, as not acting as an agent of a government, can you remember any time that you've known about a meeting like that? Not Obama, but just historically speaking, so that we can imagine if there's precedent there.
You know, earlier today, I told somebody that I hadn't remembered anything, and then it came to me. I did remember something like this. It's not quite the same thing, but it's close enough. And that was what has been revealed now, I think, with fairly consistent accuracy and documentation, to have been the Nixon campaign's collusion with the South Vietnamese government in 1968 to stall on a peace process that was thought to be potentially beneficial to Nixon's opponent, Hubert Humphrey. And there were intermediaries, American nationals, with ties to the South Vietnamese government, who were used to communicate back and forth between the campaign and the South Vietnamese government. Now, I don't remember every detail of this, but the gist of it is, and there are a number of recent books about Nixon that document it, that it's fairly clear that the Johnson administration discovered that the Nixon campaign was urging the South Vietnamese not to reach an agreement about peace talks for fear that in the waning days of the campaign, it would be the boost that Humphrey needed. And in fact, as you recall, Humphrey lost, but by a hair. The election was a lot closer than it originally been projected. And Johnson knew about it, confronted Nixon on it, and Nixon denied it, which wasn't true. And whether it had an effect on the outcome of the election, I don't know. But that was a clear case of a collaboration of a campaign with a foreign government to achieve a campaign objective.
Now, do you think it's important? I mean, you said whether it had an effect on the outcome of the election, who knows? The same is true of the Watergate break-in. I think most concerned don't think that that turned up any information that influenced the campaign and the election. But is it important in this case that Junior didn't get any of the dirt he was seeking? I mean, he keeps saying, well, if it didn't go anywhere, then it's not criminal. Then it was just a fool's errand.
There are a couple of weaknesses in his argument, in his position. One is sort of a narrow weakness. The other one is a broader weakness. Then if I could, let me break them out. The narrow weakness is that, in my view, at a minimum, even with the information not being what he thought it would be at the meeting, the email exchange coupled by the meeting potentially constitutes, under the federal campaign finance laws, an illegal solicitation of a foreign national. A foreign national came and said, I wonder whether you'd be interested. We might have information of the following kind. The campaign says, let's set up a meeting. Let me hear what you have. Because as Donald Trump Jr. says in one of the emails, if it is what you say it is, I love it. Then the meeting takes place and the wares that were displayed apparently were not to his liking, or whatever she said he has subsequently told us. And of course, this is his account. Didn't make any sense. It was vague. But clearly was communicated, on the part of the campaign, an interest in having the Russians give them whatever they had that might be useful in discrediting Hillary Clinton. And given the very broad definition of what constitutes a solicitation under the federal campaign finance laws, it seems to me that's clearly a problem. Then there's a broader concern here that this meeting, and this is where I think Trump's confidence that this doesn't amount to much, Trump Jr.'s confidence is misplaced. This meeting evidences, whatever the outcome was, that the Trump campaign was aware and believed that the Russian government was looking to find ways to support the Trump campaign, that it was offering to be helpful, and the Trump campaign was open to that. And so to the extent that we look at all the activities, public and private, over the course of the balance of the campaign, or not just the balance of the campaign, what came before and what came afterward, then we have, it seems to me, a pretty clear-cut case here of intent, a willingness to work with the Russian government toward the shared goal of Donald Trump winning the White House. So the one example I'll give you just right now off the top of my head is only a few weeks later, in the third week of July, Donald Trump himself calls on the Russians publicly to locate the stolen emails, the stolen and supposedly deleted emails of Secretary Clinton. He says, you know, I hope you're listening. Will you find them?
This is the Trump's family strategy of doing cloak and dagger work without the cloak.
Yeah, exactly. But the curious part is, later it was said, well, you know, it was a joke. He was just joking. That was the defense. Well, now, when you look back at what happened previously, these private communications, which, after all, are the only ones we have, there may be others, it casts a completely different light on this joke. It suggests it wasn't a joke at all. And then if we also examine how over the course of the campaign, again, just working with what we know, Trump wouldn't acknowledge that the Russians were interfering. That's odd, because there was a letter to his son saying that's, in fact, exactly what they were doing. And he wouldn't denounce them for interfering. He wouldn't condemn them. He wouldn't ask them not to do it. These emails, I think, color the interpretation of a lot of other facts, and I think connect a number of dots in a way that I think belies the confidence that Donald Trump Jr. has that this was a, you know, I don't recall who said it recently, but maybe it was Reince Priebus said it was a nothing burger. I think, frankly, the prosecutor and the congressional investigating commissions will find it quite nourishing.
So also, you know, in the sort of breaking down the Trump defense, which, you know, amounts to a bunch of tweets by them and their cohort, does it matter who called the meeting? If Natalia Veselnitskaya, the Russian government lawyer, or if Donald Trump Jr. called it? I think Veselnitskaya has said, although this doesn't seem to be borne out in the emails, that they were quite eager to meet and were, you know, hardly kind of dragged into this meeting as a favor to Goldstone. Does it matter who called the meeting? I guess that's the point. Leaving outside the emails, but just as a point of law.
No, I don't think either on both of the points that I raised with you, sort of the broad point and the narrow point. I don't think it matters in the least. On the broad point, it's still very clear that whether it was initiated on the Russian side or initiated on the Trump side, in either case, the Trump campaign evidenced a willingness to entertain campaign support from a foreign government. And on the narrow point, I can assure you that under the regulations of the Federal Election Commission, whoever put out the first suggestion of a meeting doesn't matter to whether or not it's ultimately considered to be an illegal solicitation. But there's one broader context here within which these individual episodes, I think, are appropriately evaluated. And that is, we know for a fact, that the Trump campaign viewed as its strategic imperative acquiring what it believed to be smoking gun discrediting information about Hillary Clinton. Their game plan included, to a large extent, continually reminding prospective voters they hope to attract that she was a proto-criminal of some sort, that she should have been prosecuted, she should be locked up. He, at one point, candidate Trump, said that he was going to direct a prosecution of Hillary Clinton. And they were very, very anxious to pursue that as what I think they thought was what was perhaps most essential to whatever prospects of victory that he had. And if anyone looking at this as a case, you know, takes that into account, what it suggests and what and how it ultimately provides some sort of narrative overview of all the individual pieces of evidence is that they were motivated to do whatever it took to find and put out that kind of discrediting information. And it is a theme that runs throughout the entire campaign. Now, this is not a one-off, this experience reflected in the emails. This is not an isolated episode where all of a sudden he thought, well, that's an interesting suggestion. Maybe I'll talk to these people. I suspect we would find, if we looked at the internal email traffic or campaign strategic documents, that this was one of the leads, if you will, one of the sort of strategic imperatives, strategic goals that mattered as much and probably more than any other.
I mean, you have a less prosecutorial cast of mind, which I'm grateful for, than sometimes guests on here, maybe I'm inclined to. But it still seems that while we're talking about Russian meddling in the election, which seems to be well established, and we're hinting at a discussion of collusion, that we really are bordering on a conversation about treason, meaning that the collusion and meddling worked. And now, you know, that Jared Kushner also went on that meeting, still has national security clearance. Now that he's talked about establishing a back channel post-election victory, that now we have, in some ways, who cares what happened a year ago? We have trouble on our hands. We have Trump just met with Putin. How much should that be topic A? You know, sort of, I mean, I know that we're very systematically going over the meddling and then collusion issues, but what about this broader, more pressing issue of, do we have a Russian agent for a president?
Well, I think, you know, what you're raising is the question of, you know, do we have here, in a very unusual respect, because it involves a foreign national, the concern that maybe for other reasons, but certainly because of the campaign support that he got from them, Donald Trump owes something to the Russians. You know, that first of all, he came to the relationship predisposed to like them, maybe because of their prior involvement with him in his business. Then they proved to be, you know, helpful to him. We can't know what effect all of this had on the election, but I'm sure he was grateful for the support from that quarter. That's fairly clear from the email exchange and the showing of the senior campaign brass at that meeting. And so then the question is, you know, do we have at work in the way he thinks about American national interest some accrued gratitude to the Russians for both their business largesse and for their political favors shown to him? And I think that is, you know, that's a legitimate concern. I mean, more than legitimate concern. Obviously, there are a variety of reasons why we prohibit foreign nationals from attempting to influence the outcome of elections. But all the way back to the founding, there has been a profound concern. Recently, by the way, you know, the Supreme Court took up a case on this issue and sort of roundingly affirmed the point, a profound concern with protecting the integrity of decision-making within our political community so that the outcome of American elections are decided by Americans.
Can you review that Supreme Court case for me? Because I don't know. I didn't follow it.
Yes. Well, there's a case that decided not too long ago, just a few years ago, post-Citizens United, by the way, decided by the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia and affirmed by the Supreme Court, entitled Blumen versus Federal Election Commission. And it involved two individuals, one a Canadian citizen and one with dual Canadian and Israeli citizenship, if I remember correctly, who challenged the law's prohibition on their making any contribution whatsoever to a political campaign in the United States. And that their view was that zeroing them out completely when, you know, they might want to give to a local official or a small amount to a congressional candidate or whatever, it violated their rights, that it was unconstitutional. And the Supreme Court, United States Court of Appeals held against them, and the Supreme Court affirmed. And the U.S. Court of Appeals decision is very, very remarkable for its emphasis on the unique nature of the state interest in keeping foreign national influence out of the electoral process. Mm-hmm. That this is something, this involves a fundamental conception and definition of what the court referred to as the American political community. That had to be delimited in some way for democracy to function and to produce legitimate results. And therefore, even if it meant that this, you know, a couple of perfectly, you know, reasonable individuals without nefarious intent, you know, one a Canadian Israeli, couldn't make a $150, $250 contribution, well, so be it, because we had to protect this conception of the American political community. So there is a, you know, there's a very, very strong interest at work here, and that makes it different from the normal campaign finance or election influencing case. And it ties into the concern that you expressed about what it might mean to allow election influencing activity by foreign governments and then have office holders who, rather than being responsive to an American, you know, electoral constituency, might be influenced by the interests of foreign powers. And as you know, all the way back to the founding and specific provisions of the Constitution that address that concern about, you know, foreign powers having some control over the actions of elected officials, this is a long-standing issue in American constitutional and legal history.
I also want to ask you to, just as an explainer, tell me where the treason word and laws against it stand in relation to today's and yesterday's revelations.
In truth, you know, I know that Senator Kaine mentioned that, you know, that has to be considered. I don't know what he had in mind. I haven't honestly looked at it. I've been entirely focused on just straight up campaign law problems that are presented by a campaign that cooperates with a foreign government. So I don't have anything terribly informed to tell you about that. Obviously, that is an issue that's an issue now that having been raised also brings you in mind of the sorts of offenses that could be raised in an impeachment proceeding. But I don't know that Senator Kaine had that in mind. I didn't hear the full range of his comment on that and whether he meant that as well or not.
For your meticulous and measured treatment of the last two stressful days, I'm really, really grateful. Are you worried for the fate of our nation? That's my final question for you.
It's interesting that you put the question that way. Everybody likes it, almost now to the point of just overflow, you know, quoting Benjamin Franklin on the point that we have a Republican, but only if we can keep it. You know, I actually have a lot of confidence that we have institutions that can contend with strains on the system like this and misconduct that can put strain on the systems like this. I mean, I lived through I was young, but I still, you know, hung on every word, followed every development in Watergate and have spent a lot of time studying it since. And there were huge stresses, to say the least, on the system over the whole period of time, which in the aggregate is referred to as the Watergate episode. Truthfully, I think we're entirely up to it. This isn't good. This isn't good for government. It isn't good for the credibility of the United States and its capacity to address, obviously, you know, very significant issues that are waiting to be addressed and have been waiting in many cases too long to be addressed. And these questions are going to get resolved, and I think they will be squarely confronted. So nobody, you know, should take these sorts of upheavals lightly, to say the least. And I think there's what's sometimes called in the corporate sector a good after-action report when this is all done and resolved that needs to be prepared on a whole host of issues. But I'm not worried that we don't have the capacity as a democracy to handle this problem, this set of issues, to get to the bottom of what happened and then to come up with appropriate resolutions.
I am so grateful for your confidence, Bob, and your time. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that's our show for today. But come on, before we take off, are you following TrumpCast on Twitter? I know you're following some other political podcasts, but you've got to follow @RealTrumpCast. So accept no substitutes. Follow us @RealTrumpCast on Twitter. Today's show was produced by Jason DeLeon. I'm Virginia Heffernan, and thanks for listening to TrumpCast.